dropping 7 feet to the earth, slamming his head on the ground. The man was using his arms to turn over when the deserters stepped on him, no doubt caving his ribs in, as he gave one short gurgling cry before it was cut off. The three Sildunes circled the deserter and cut him down without any of them sustaining an injury. And as I finished spanning the crossbow, I looked around the still smoky battlefield. Any organization had completely broken down, and Sildune were fighting deserters everywhere in random clumps, a chaotic tableau out of the worst nightmare. I saw as Morgon ride past a deserter engaged with another Sildune, his chopper extended to the side to allow him to strike from as far away as possible. The deserter struck the Sildune full in the chest, carrying him out of the saddle, the long translucent spikes buried to the haft for a moment, before the body flew free and the spikes pulled out, trails of blood streaming behind. As Morgon arrived too late to save him, but angled his blow up, the tip of the odd pole arm catching the deserter in the side of the neck as he passed. The giant dropped to a knee, reached out a hand to steady itself, but as Morgon circled back around and slashed again across the giant's face. I turned away as the deserter fell backward, dead or dying, crushing the man in the barrel on its back. Part of me hoped the man died immediately, and part of me hoped he suffocated slowly. 20 yards away, I saw a deserter swing the spiked club, striking Maldus's horse in the neck. The poor beast screamed and fell to its side. Maldus managed to free his feet from the stirrups and roll as the horse toppled, but the deserter was nearly on him as the lieutenant tried to regain his feet, unsteady and wobbling. A bolt struck the deserter in the hand, hitting it to the flat haft of the club, and another hit him in the shoulder, missing the armor but still not buried deep in the exposed flesh. The deserter roared and turned to face its new foes, while the javelin thrower was pulling another from his quiver, presumably to throw at Maldus. However, even teetering and robbed of some of his dexterity, Maldus acted fast. He took 3 ungainly steps, launched himself off the dead horse and into the air, and slashed at the man in the barrel with his falchion at the height of his leap. It was clumsy and awkward, and he bounced off the barrel and hit the dirt hard. But the javelin thrower was slumped over the edge of the barrel, blood pouring down the planks in a curtain, arms dangling, the javelin on the ground. The other two Sildune took out the deserter as Maldus got to his feet and moved off at a crouching jog, looking for another horse or a new deserter to attack. While the deserters were massive, several times stronger than any man, had reach, and hardened leather and brass armor in addition to their already thick hides that gave them inordinate protection, and many had men in barrels throwing javelins from on high, the Sildune outnumbered them greatly. Men and horses were brutally struck down, but the Sildune were overwhelming the deserters, regaining their cohesion, sweeping past and staying out of reach, flanking with coordinated attacks, or using the crossbows to good effect now that the smoke had dissipated enough to see more than 5 feet. It looked like Braelar's company was going to survive this battle, no matter how severe the casualties. They were going to defeat the hulking monsters. And that's when I saw the first female deserter, 50 yards away, surveying the carnage. Though she was a foot or two shorter than the male deserters, and spindly, where they were preposterously huge, I was still sure I couldn't have missed her earlier. Unlike the warriors doling out horrible damage among the Sildune, she wasn't outfitted in any kind of armor, but had on a bright green robe that flowed loose about her limbs. I suddenly felt my skin tighten and the hairs on every part of my body stand on end, and I scanned the field until I saw Sofjian, her blood-stained Rancer, at her side. I cupped my hands in front of my mouth and screamed her name. It took 2 tries before she heard, and a 3rd before she identified the source, and once I had her attention, I gestured wildly at the robed figure and then hurried to span my crossbow. Sofjian looked in her direction as the robed deserter slowly raised both arms, several strips of green cloth fluttering from her thin limbs. I fumbled with a crossbow bolt as I noticed her four thick fingers splayed on each outstretched hand. I was nearly done cranking the lever back when I saw Sofjian extend her rancer in front of her in one hand, with the other splayed as well. But just as I released the claws and was about to drop the bolt in place, I suddenly saw nothing but horrible, blinding, flashing light everywhere around me. So intense that each pulse was like a physical blow to my head. When I was a child and left to my own devices, I tried to see how long I could look directly at the sun on a cloudless day, testing myself to go further each time, until even shutting my eyes left the after-image of the fiery ball still there, searing. My mother caught me at it once, spun me around by the shoulders, and slapped my face, telling me my foolishness was going to give her a blind, useless son. This was similar, only 1,000, 1,000 times worse. The pulsing white light was so painful, it caused me to reel, and I nearly fell off my horse. Eyes closed, the assault still continued, and then it was combined with a shrill whistling noise that grew louder and louder. I brought my forearms up to my ears, desperately trying not to let go of the crossbow as my head swam and my stomach roiled. It felt like the deserter was assaulting me from the inside out, and my whole body was rebelling against me, and I was sure I was going to pass out, or die, when it just as suddenly stopped. I blinked, sparks and black spots filling my vision in equal measure, bent over, clutching my stomach with one hand. Still queasy, it was all I could do to try to sit up straight. Everywhere around me, Sildoon were suffering as much as I was, disoriented, in pain, trying to figure out what had happened and why it had stopped. The javelin throwers on the backs of the remaining deserters fared no better, and even the eyeless giants seemed to be struggling to regain their balance. But they recovered much faster and proceeded to roam the battlefield, some striking down disoriented jackals, though most were using the flat of their hafts of the staves of their long slings to subdue them. Only one or two killed Sildoon with the spiked clubs. I looked at Sofjian. She was still in the same spot, her arms outstretched, but shaking now, and her face was nearly as red as her cloak and hair. The robed deserter was in the same position as well, though she was slowly pivoting until she fixed on Sofjian. I dropped the bolt in, hands shaking, bile in my mouth, head spinning, and slowly raised the crossbow, looking down the length, trying to keep the weapon steady as I aimed at the robed deserter, which was nearly impossible. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Sofjian suddenly drop her rancer and collapse, falling over onto her horse's neck. Taking a final breath, I squeezed the long trigger and watched the bolt whiz just over the robed deserter's shoulder. Having dispatched Sofjian, she turned her attention back to the rest of the Sildoon company, arms rising up again. Braelar was the only Sildoon who hadn't seemed affected by her attack. He charged, embattled shield on his arm, Bloodsounder held high. The female deserter saw him coming, pivoted and faced him, arms outstretched as if she were going to push him from 50 yards away. The captain tilted slightly in his saddle, but kept galloping. I was spanning the crossbow again, watching him, sure he would kill this giantess just as he had Ruzjenna in the streets of Sunrak, and knew we would triumph again, thanks to that cursed flail. But then two massive deserters stepped in his path to intercept him, one with a staff, the other with a spiked club. Braelar changed direction, tried to race past the one on his right, and nearly made it. But the deserter swung the staff wide, extended it with his hulking left arm stretched completely. Braelar might as well have run into a huge tree branch. The staff struck him across the chest and vaulted him out of the saddle. Scorn kept galloping. Then the blinding light and deafening sounds erupted again. I did drop the crossbow this time. Even with my eyes clamped shut and my hands over my ears, there was no stopping it. The blinding light and shrieking whistle were deep in my skull, threatening to explode it from the inside out. Turning to the side, I vomited and gagged and vomited again, and my horse started forward as I toppled from the saddle, falling as if the ground had opened up underneath me and I were dropping through an endless abyss. I heard screaming, and wasn't sure if it was mine or someone else's. My final thought was a curse directed at myself for being such a poor shot. If only I had been 4 inches lower. And then all was black. The abyss absorbed the light and the sound, and left me in the absolute dark with only the thumping of my heart beating fast all around me. And faster still, pounding at a frenzied pace like one of the oversized drums in the hippodrome back at Sunrack. Until that stopped too. Chapter 16. I woke up and felt the ground shifting and rumbling beneath me, and thought I must have still been in the grip of the spell the spindly deserter had cast. But then I realized it wasn't the ground at all, but us, as I ran my hands over the wooden planks of a broad wagon bed. All around me, Sildoon were crowded close, some curled into balls as much their armor allowed, a few groggily leaning up against the wooden side of the wagon, some supine, staring vacantly into the cloudless sky. There were nearly 20 of us packed in there. My head pounded 1,000 times worse than anything wine or sickness had ever accomplished. It felt as if a deserter were squeezing my skull in its humongous hands, intent on crushing it to pulp. I tasted blood, and my tongue felt raw and bloated, and I realized I must have bitten it at some point, likely when I screamed myself into oblivion. The wagon stank of sweat and piss and vomit and shit. One awful stench knotted with the rest, and it was all I could do not to vomit myself. I couldn't tell if I had or not. My gambeson was soaked in sweat, but I didn't think the vomit was emanating from me. The wagon shifted again, and my bones shifted with it, feeling as brittle as glass. I tried to reposition myself to get slightly more comfortable and discovered that my wrist was shackled to an iron loop on the side of the wagon, and there weren't even enough links to stand up. I leaned against the boards and looked over the edge as much as the short chain allowed. We were on a road, and while the overall terrain hadn't changed much, the position of the sun said we had been traveling for half a day, or longer. I imagined I would have pissed myself if it had been more than a day, and it didn't feel as if I had, and my bladder ached. Every time we jostled over the smallest stone or a crack in the road, I thought my head was going to explode like a melon dropped from the highest battlements. It was so very difficult to think, but it suddenly hit me that this was the largest wagon I'd ever seen, and since the humans feared horses, I assumed some other beast of burden must have been pulling it. I craned my neck and rose as much as the shackle permitted and looked ahead, feeling dizzy and then nearly throwing up as my stomach lurched when I saw what was harnessed to the wagon. 4 swaying rooters, or something closely related to the beasts I had first seen in the Green Sea with Loy and Braelar, each 2 or 3 times the girth and length of an ox or a bull, their knobby hides broken up by tufts of bristly hair here and there. There was a human walking alongside in simple linen trousers, goad in one hand, whip in the other, his own scarred back sweaty and dirty. It didn't look like he fared much better than the rooters, who also bore whitish scars on their flanks. One of the beasts grunted and snapped its huge mouth at the rooter alongside it, and the whip snapped out across the hilly backside. The whip would have torn a man's flesh from his bones, or drawn blood at the very least, but it didn't even leave a mark on the rooter's thick flesh. I heard the deserter before I saw him, his footfalls heavier than any creature's in the world, or at least the other half of the world. Who could say what was normal or common on this side? The sun shone off the brass plates, giving it an almost wet look, and for some reason that made me nauseous, and I started to look away as the giant ambled past, but stopped when I saw the man in the cylinder case on its back looking down, his hand next to the quiver of javelins, as if he were just looking for an excuse to pluck one up and pin someone to the wagon with it. Vindiro said, "Starting to really develop a strong kind of dislike for those legless bastards." He was a few prisoners away, and looked as green as I felt. That should have provided a queer kind of comfort, but I hurt too much to feel anything good at all. Knowing he was alive was some true consolation, though. Another Sildu next to him said, "Probably got no choice, Sarge. That is, Lieutenant." Vindiro glared at him. "I don't care if the deserters lopped those legs off at birth or yesterday. A man's always got a choice, especially when it comes to who he kills or who he don't. He killed his own kind." The jackal persisted. "Deserters would probably lop off his head if he didn't do it, is all I mean. And we're nothing to him, Lieutenant."
"We're plaguing human, you ass. That one, who just went by in the basket, I saw him put a javelin through Minx, right through his throat, before that she-devil deserter took us all out. You can bet I get a chance, I'm lopping off that bastard's arms, and leaving him alive to roll around, and wish he had let the deserters kill him when he had a chance."
That shut the other soldier up. We were moving around a gentle curve in the road, and I stretched to look above the short wooden wall of the wagon to see behind us. There were two more identical wagons pulled by rooters, the first as full of prisoners as our own, the second not nearly as much. So what had been over 150 men leaving Sunrak had been cut down to about a third of that number. All the horses were tethered and trailing behind the third wagon, and deserters marched alongside the whole procession. There were a handful of humans as well around the wagons, servants or slaves, there mostly to goad the rooters along, walking with staves and costrels. While they'd left us in armor and allowed me to keep my writing case, assuming it wasn't a weapon, I hoped my translated pages and the remainder of the texts were still on the horses back there, and then felt guilty for worrying over ink and parchment when so many lives had been lost so quickly. I wasn't even sure who among Braelar's retinue was still alive besides Vindiro. With so many bodies turned and contorted, it was difficult to tell even in our own wagon. I didn't see Asmorgon's bulk or the captain amongst the men, though there was no mistaking Muldus's pale, stubbly scalp on the other end of our wagon, his head slumped over his knees, which were pulled up to his chest. Half of the soldiers around us were still dead to the world, possibly for good, though if so, I imagined the deserters would have left them behind with the rest of the corpses. I called out to the lieutenant, whispering as much as I could, but loud enough to carry.
"Muldus! The captain?"
He looked up, with half his mouth still curled in a nearly permanent snarl, and said,
"Can't say. Saw him still struggling against that robed bitch when I went black. Him and his witch sister. Last thing I saw was the pair of them trying to stay upright."
He called out loud enough for everyone in the wagon to hear.
"Anybody seen Cap?"
Those that were awake and moderately alert looked around, and one at the rear of the wagon said,
"Pretty sure I seen him back there, Lieutenant, looking around a while back."
"Pretty sure? That's what you're plaguing telling me, you scabby twat? Pretty sure?"
The Sildoon looked like he wished he never spoke.
"Think so."
I looked at Muldus.
"Asmorgon? Sofjian?"
He could only muster evil in the eye that wasn't obscured by a sagging lid.
"If you think I give two shits about the ogre or the witch, then the deserter witch cunt churned your brain something awful."
I was glad I hadn't been closer, or he might have clubbed me with his big arm. It struck me that this was how Henlister must have felt, trapped in his wagon. Well, he wasn't surrounded by creatures long presumed to be deities, or hulking rooters on the wrong side of the god veil. But the sensation of having had everything taken from him, possessions, future, possibly life, and traveling to a destination he had no knowledge of, that I could absolutely relate to. And there was no likelihood of anyone riding to our rescue. I had always assumed getting captured by the Imperials was the worst thing that could happen to us. I was so very, very wrong. If they suddenly materialized and somehow overwhelmed the deserters, taking us captive in their name, I imagine most of the jackals would have been relieved. Human captors, even vengeful or furious ones, were a known evil. We had no idea what terrors the deserters might visit upon us. It was clear they had no qualms about severing men nearly in half and using them for their own purposes. A soldier next to me roused, convulsed, then got his legs underneath him enough to rise up and vomit down the side of the wagon. The smell made another Sildoon a little further gag, but he managed to keep the contents of his stomach inside. Or had already emptied it. It was hard to tell, before saying,
"Gods, Kithric, what did you plaguing eat? Rotten yak?"
One of the human slaves, or very poorly cared for servant, walking along the side of our wagon, handed the closest Sildoon a leather costrel of some fluid or other. The jackal grabbed it, sniffed the short spout, and then figured if our captors wanted us dead, they could have done the job easily enough when we were all unconscious. He took a swig as we all watched, waited just to be sure he hadn't been poisoned anyway, and then handed it to the soldier next to him. The slave was watching the Sildoon drink, apparently waiting to reclaim the costrel after it made the rounds. He had a narrow face and a nose bent in several directions, as if uncertain where to go. It looked nearly useless to breathe out of. Half his head was shaved, and the dark hair on the other half was in multiple braids that formed a curtain on his shoulder. There was intelligence in the close-set eyes, even as he looked wary and skittish, and a disturbing design branded or scarred onto his cheek. I scooted as close to him as I could, earning a curse from the Sildoon next to me who just vomited, and then said in my best old Injurian, "Where are they taking us?" The slave's expression turned nearly to horror when he realized I spoke his language, or some butchered version of it anyway, and he started to sidle away. I said, "Wait, please, tell me your name. Please." The man looked uncertain, perplexed, possibly still frightened. It was hard to be sure. He took a small step back towards the wagon as he kept walking alongside, but not so close that he could be grabbed by anyone inside. Staring straight ahead, several moments passed. Finally, he whispered, "Bulto." And then again, with slightly more force and volume, as if he hadn't told anyone his name in a long time and had forgotten how to do so. "Bulto." I lowered my voice. "Arki. I am Arki. Where are we going, Bulto?" Bulto looked immediately ready to bolt again, but after deliberating and looking around as he kept pace, he said,
"Roxdiniac. You go to Roxdiniac to see the matriarch."
Or what I assumed meant matriarch, or mother. It was hard to be sure.
Roxdiniac, he repeated, slowly.
I struggled to think of the word for region, so I tried,
"City? Or a place? Is it a place?"
He seemed to understand city, and he nodded.
"Big,"
I think he said, though there was more to it than that. But that seemed to be the gist. "Big."
"Thank you, Bulto," I replied, and tried to smile.
He was staring at me, when we both heard a deserter bellow something at him I couldn't understand, clipped and guttural. The man's face went pale, except for his crooked nose, which appeared incapable of changing hue. He spun around and raised his arms above his head. The deserter took three broad strides, covering a remarkable amount of ground very quickly, and backhanded the man across the face. The giant hadn't put much force behind the blow, but Bulto still slammed into the wagon and fell to the road, looking up, his nose rebroken, blood on his lips as he opened his mouth and pleaded. While the deserter didn't strike him again, he bent down low, grabbed Bulto, and lifted him to his feet the way a father might a disobedient child that had suddenly gone limp. Bulto was still babbling so quickly I couldn't make any of the words out, even if they were some variant of old Injurian. With thick lips curling, the deserter shouted something in Bulto's face, pointed at our wagon, scolded him a final time, and then stalked off. Bulto sagged slightly, knees weak, and I thought he might fall to the ground again, but he steadied himself against the wagon, wiped the blood off his chin, and walked away without another word. Apparently he no longer cared about the Kostril. I heard Muldu say, slur really,
"Learn anything useful before you went and nearly got that scrawny prick killed."
I asked where they were taking us. I replied.
"And?"
he asked. I looked down the road, not knowing what the answer meant. "He said we're heading to a big city called Rocksteiniac, at least I think it's a city, to see the matriarch." Muldus grabbed the Kostril from the soldier next to him.
"Matriarch, huh?"
After a large swig, and with water dribbling down his chin, he added,
"Prefer to look a person in the eyes before gutting them. Guess I'll have to forego that pleasure when I off this giant matriarch horse cunt."
We rolled along for a few more hours, and what struck me most was how unpopulated the area was. There were the skeletal remains of some ancient human villages and small towns, mostly fallen to the ground with the remaining structures reclaimed by nature, almost entirely obscured by bramble and vines and moss and thorny trees and grass. But no deserter holdfasts of communities, and no sign that men lived on this side of the Vale, except for the few slaves traveling among us and those workers we first saw climbing the columns. After passing a few more long-dead settlements, our road connected with another broader avenue, and not long after, we saw some populated farming settlements at the base of some hills, though at some distance from the road. The dwellings themselves looked simple and sparse, but what caught the attention was the hilly land beyond. I'd only seen agriculture and farming on level land, but here, the hillside had been cut into terraces, the face of each covered in stone, and the crops on each level going up the entirety of the hill. The figures, or farmers, were difficult to make out, but I saw straw hats. No matter what side of the Vale you were on, or who your overlords were, the sun was the sun, and the floppy hat, your friend. An hour later, we rounded a bend, and I saw something that stopped my breath in my chest for a moment. There was the same warping, twisting alien energy that composed the God Vale. Only this time, instead of being shaped into a towering curtain, it was bent into a massive dome in the middle of the plain. And the road led directly towards it. It was only after gaping and feeling the nausea return that I realized there were several large carts coming towards us and away from the dome, pulled by single rooters, and with deserters seated in them, and human slaves goading the beasts. As they got closer, I saw the deserters weren't dressed like our captors at all in their leather and brass armor, but outfitted in clothing that was utterly plain in color, having none at all, being undyed linen and wool and silk, but gaudy in design, nonetheless. Voluminous sleeves adorned with bells and tiny strips of cloth somewhere between fringe and streamers. Belts crisscrossing their chests, festooned with metal baubles and strangely patterned badges. The giant horned occupants of the cairns gawked as they passed our procession, or at least gave that impression. Without eyes, it was difficult to say for certain. But while they were a different caste or profession than the giant deserter warriors escorting us, their chalky skin was equally marked in those faint swirly designs, asymmetrical and elaborate and arcane. One slim female in the cairn shook her head slowly as she took us in. Her lips curled in what can only be distaste, and she ordered the slave to hurry the router along. When our convoy was 100 yards out, the tang of vinegar reached our noses, even more intense and powerful than the smell approaching the Godveil. And as we got closer, I saw that the dome was somehow more tangible. Where the Godveil masked what lay beyond, disguised it in the shifting currents of energy like heat waves, you could still discern the shape or outline of things. But this dome was less translucent, and the rippling was more like the shifting waves in a deep lake than the eddying energies of the Godveil. More substantial, somehow. Nearly opaque, and not even showing the silhouette of what lay beyond. I swallowed hard as we rolled closer, and felt the same trepidation as I had approaching the Godveil. There was the horrible compulsion to continue towards it, a drawing that was nearly irresistible, as well as the certainty that doing so would only bring madness or death, except the choice to continue or turn back was no longer ours. And we no longer had Bloodsounder to protect us. I was sure the deserters hadn't captured us for any other reason than to sacrifice us to this thing, and I looked around and saw similar fears, even on the faces of these hardened and oft-times brutal soldiers. The deserters heading the other way must have been making a pilgrimage or a sacrifice or something else. But I felt absolute terror wash over me just then. Absolute and irrefutable. We were being led to our slaughter. That was the only explanation. But then our procession stopped, and a deserter continued on ahead, walking down the road, closing in on the oscillating mercurial dome. I pulled my chains tight to try to get a better vantage point, and I wasn't the only one. The deserter raised a fist, shouted something that would have been unintelligible, even if I had understood the tongue, and then turned and slowly walked back to rejoin his massive brethren ahead of our wagon. I waited, straining, feeling the pull of the rippling surface of the dome, and the terror of it too. And then suddenly another deserter appeared, walking through the wall of the dome, approaching our procession, and even from a distance, I noticed the obvious difference in size and physique. She was outfitted like the other female we'd seen during the battle, the one who had ensorcelled an entire company of Sildoon. The one difference being she had a long spine projecting up between her shoulders and above her head, fitted to a harness on her back. She gave a cursory and arrogant nod to her deserter captors. It was odd, but still comforting in a way, to see these giants exhibiting behavior that wasn't completely alien to our own. Apparently there would always be castes and hierarchies, even among demons, demigods, or monsters. Our captors bowed low, maintained the deferential pose for several beats, and then rose again. One of them exchanged a few words with the slender female, and she seemed to be looking us over as she listened. Then she strode past the warriors. Every deserter bowed as she moved past, and it was clear they afforded her a great deal of respect. The deserter with the spine stopped alongside our wagon, and I shivered as she slowly turned her head. Even eyeless, it was clear the giant was examining us. From behind me, I heard Muldus say,
"Think the bish will understand old Andurian, Scribbler?"
I didn't turn around as I whispered. "I don't know. The slave did. Somewhat, though the language has diverged from what I studied." "Why?" Muldus said.
"Well, go on and tell that mass of ugly devil we're an exploring party from the mighty Sildoon Plaguing Empire. Diplomats, envoys, representatives, however you want to plaguing put it. Make it real plaguing clear that fucking with us is a real bad idea."
"Is that wise? Maybe we should..." The deserter continued scanning us, looking over each prisoner in turn, head cocked slightly to the side, exhaling deeply every time she finished taking in one and moving on to the next. Muldus almost shouted,
"Just plaguing do it, Inkstain.
Right quick. Don't like the look of this bitch one bit.
I conveyed the lieutenant's sentiments, minus the profanity and unveiled threat. She turned and regarded me, and my words practically turned to dust in my mouth as she cocked her head to the side. Though shorter than the males, she still towered over all of us. Her lips peeled back in what could have either been a sneer, or a smile, or a snarl. Then she slowly raised both arms above her head, cocked at the elbows. Muldoose yelled,
"Did you plaguing tell her, Rocky?"
I nodded slowly as in a dream, watching in terror as she grasped the spine in both hands, feeling a mystical draft rolling over me, lifting the hairs all over my body.
"Well, tell her again, you skinny prick," Muldoose rasped. "Tell her whatever she's about to plaguing do is a real bad plaguing."
But the moment ended. The charge of whatever esoteric thing she had worked was gone. The deserter released the spine, turned her head to Muldoose, and said in halting Saldunian,
"This one understands you well enough, white worm." The matriarch said, "Deliver alive." She said nothing about you having your tongue. Easy enough to pluck it out by the roots.
Muldoose somehow went paler than usual, but he leaned forward, pulling the chains taut before saying,
"You just crawl in this wagon and try it, you behemoth bitch."
The deserter grinned, predatory, and gave a clicking chuckle of sorts before moving down the line to the next wagon. Muldoose fell back against the side of the wagon and slammed the heel of his hand into the floorboards several times. The deserter went through the same motions at the wagon behind us, examining, then grasping the spine. Venduro leaned over and said to me,
"Well, at least you won't have to struggle none trying to figure out how to tell them to go fuck themselves in old Endurian, eh? Muldoose can do it just fine in perfectly good Saldunian."
When the deserter finished approaching each wagon in turn and examining everyone inside, she walked to the front of the procession once more. The human slaves got the rooters moving again, and the wagons continued rolling over the well-paved road that led directly into the dome. The tangy sting of vinegar grew more powerful as we moved towards the oscillating and scintillating surface of the dome. Only we weren't clasped hand to hand to Captain Kilcoyne, or protected by Bloodsounder at all. But the deserters and human slaves walked forward nonchalantly, clearly not worried about madness or death. The first of them parted the warping, gently curved veil, disappearing from view entirely. The rooters at the front of the wagon moved through as if the veil dome weren't there at all. As we approached, I didn't feel the tug that I had when we crossed the god veil. I felt nothing at all. At least until the wagon moved me into the pulsing weft and weave itself. Then it was as if my mind were being cast about in a tempest, twisted, torn. Consciousness stretched. I saw thousands of flashes of human memories, each a separate current flowing against the rest. Powerful, awful, in danger of pulling me under and swallowing me completely. There were sensations I recognized as they washed over me, sounds of animals growling, splashing water and children crying, cries of joy and fury, the scent of lemongrass, the feeling of an embrace. The pleasure and bite of pain as a blister popped and tore. The shock of icy river water up to my thighs. The howling of wind that precedes a hellish storm. The smell of rooter dung, piled high. There was also a rush of some other alien sensations that were so overwhelming and beyond the scope of anything I'd ever experienced, I nearly vomited. It felt like an eternity of being churned in the eddy. And then we were suddenly through, though it was clear we had only physically traveled a few feet. I shook my head, trying to clear it, feeling nauseous and faint and hot, as if struck by sickness. It seemed to pass quickly, and then I saw what was inside the dome, a few hundred yards away. A wondrous, massive, and completely alien city that could only serve as sanctuary for the deserters. Roxtiniac. We continued rumbling towards it, and the first thing that stood out was that while the city was walled, with much higher walls than any human settlement, there was no dry or wet moat. The road led to a simple but massive gate, open wide, and a gatehouse, but no drawbridge or portcullis, and no flanking towers nearby, no hoardings or battlements, no siege engines on top of wide towers along the walls, no arrow loops in the few towers that did break up the wall. In short, none of the defensive constructions or developments that would have marked any human city of this size. But of course, with a mystical dome preventing approach, all that was rendered irrelevant. Had the deserter with the spine not examined us and somehow marked us as able to pass through, I was certain we would all be dead. As we rolled towards the open gate, I wondered why there were any walls at all. I looked over at Muldus, who was scowling, of course, but appraising as well. But he shared his thoughts with no one. With a wrenching sadness, I realized I'd never hear him and Hughspear banter over how they would broach a city's defenses again. No bristly arguments about possibly tunneling under the veil surrounding the city, or capturing a she-devil to breach its defenses, or any other method they might weigh and discard. We rolled between the stone walls, and while there was nothing there as marvelous or sublimely horrible as the warping dome, Roxdiniac itself was nearly as overwhelming. Simply the scale and size of things, all built to accommodate the giant inhabitants. I felt like a very small child again, overcome with awe and fear and wonder. The buildings ahead were never square or perfectly round or symmetrical, but curving in odd shapes and resembled the terraced farm we'd seen. Each level had a flat roof that was covered in undulating grass, with every upper story always smaller than the one immediately below, which gave the effect of the structures being carved out of a hill, rather than built solely of stone and wood and stucco. The rooters pulled our wagons into an expansive plaza directly on the other side of the wall that was bordered by neat rows of purple moss columns, though all empty and devoid of spikes. While they weren't so crowded as to provide a true wailing, there was a low lament as the breeze blew through the holes. There were deserters milling about everywhere in the plaza, some on large stone benches, but the majority standing or walking. Most wore flowing robes with sleeves so long and billowy they nearly trailed to the ground, and odd sashes and strips of cloth and rectangular cloaks and 100 other accoutrements that were obviously designed to add flourish or texture to the clothing, having no functional purpose at all, and looking like they would only catch on things and prove problematic. Not surprisingly, given the horns, none of the deserters were wearing hoods, hats, or cowls of any kind. And the backs of the gowns, robes, and free-flowing tunics were open halfway down the back. I presumed to show off the dual and triple manes, and the myriad ribbons, bells, and assorted doodads that were worked into them, or how they crisscrossed each other. All of them had similar designs on their skin, as if they were inscribed somehow by brand or knife or chisel, scarred and marked forever. I mentioned as much to Vindoro. He ran his hand over the inked noose at his neck and muttered, "Kind of makes our efforts look sort of amateurish, don't it?" There were only a few deserters armored like our captors, and every single one of them turned in our direction and adopted the postures of those who would be staring if they had eyes. It seemed obvious they either had never seen so many human captives at once before, or had heard that we were all armed and had killed some of their own. They turned to each other and had hushed, guttural exchanges, and one female pointed. But the most noteworthy thing wasn't the presence of so many more deserters milling about, the excessive cut of their cloth, or their behavior as they gawked at us as we rode past, but the colors, or lack of. I'd noticed it before, but now with so many deserters, the effect was striking. While it was hard to tell the caste or class from the style of clothing, one thing they all had in common was that their garb was undyed. Belts, robes, trousers, cloaks, one and all, they were the natural hue of the material, pale gray, cream, bone, tan, and devoid of the slightest hint of any dyes. The Injurians had favored earth tones and muted colors on the whole, but the deserters made their fashion seem garish and gaudy in comparison. While the clothing had many folds and studs and strange physical flourishes, it was clear that, not having eyes, they had no cause to appeal to that sense at all. The deserters were completely washed out. And that's when I noticed the same of the architecture. While many buildings had discs near the doors that were like mosaics of some kind, they were done only in tiny gray tiles or stones arranged in what might have been a pattern of some kind, but didn't cohere to form any kind of image. And while the surfaces of the buildings had hundreds of small grottos, alcoves, carvings, or other peculiar projections I assumed were ornamental, they were utterly devoid of color as well. Unlike a human city, there were no painted facades or murals, no doors of different hues. The buildings were remarkable because of the sheer scale and how asymmetrical everything was, especially compared to any human construction. But there was no effort made to distinguish, enhance, or distract with color. Most of the buildings were terraced, and some had huge bulbous towers, oddly angled promenades, and a hundred other things that made them unusual compared to human dwellings. But it was difficult to take that in, with all of the colors bleached out entirely, or never added in the first place at least. It was like seeing an alien otherworld. A few soldiers around me gave voice to similar thoughts, commenting quietly as we rumbled down a broad avenue away from the plaza. One looked at a terraced building as we rolled past.
"Just keeps getting queerer and queerer, don't it?"
Vinduro replied.
"Looks like it was built by plaguing ghosts. Giant ghosts."
The only flashes of color were small rows of mossy columns here or there, lining the avenues or glimpsed through the arched openings of walls, though the moss was so dusky purple as to be almost black, and were a result only of nature's artistry, rather than something chosen by deserter botanists on account of their color, which they must not have been able to see anyway. As we rumbled down another large avenue, gawked at by countless sightless deserters, I noticed that was another oddity. The moss columns we encountered out in the wild were present in several manicured gardens, or perfectly orchestrated rows as well, their translucent spikes shimmering in the sun. I gawked in turn, looking at the severe faces of the deserters, the stern and somewhat bewildering facades of the buildings. Vinduro said,
"Plague me, but for not having eyes of any kind, they sure do stare a lot."
Bank nodded.
"Makes my skin crawl, it does. Plaguing bastards."
Several soldiers mumbled agreement, and Muldu said,
"Spend less time yapping, you sorry sons of Oz, and more time marking things. The number of streets, landmarks, any barracks you see. We're going to get out of this plaguing city, fighting or sneaking, and we got to know where to go. You hear me?"
Bank lifted his head from his knees and laughed.
"You saw that dome, Lieutenant, like the God Veil it were. Ain't no getting out on our own, unless they decide to let us out, even if we painted ourselves a path right back to the gate."
Muldus gave him the one-eye glare and balled his hands into fists.
"Give me lip one more time, you little fuck. Go on and do it. And the second we get unhooked from the wagon here, I'm going to beat you senseless. You hear me, Bank?"
No one challenged Muldus before Ruzjenna struck him down, especially when he was glowering and working himself into a lather, even as Morgan might have thought better of it. But Bank returned the stare, long and hard, and everyone in the wagon watched to see if the lippy soldier was about to grow bold enough to challenge that threat, now that it was less likely that Muldus could actually carry it out. Finally, Bank said,
"Aye, Lieutenant, marking the city. Right."
Then he turned and spit out the side of the wagon before looking at the large oblong greenery we passed. Even more than their control of the Memrodons, or their system of recognizing and rewarding talent over heredity, or their cunning or viciousness, the thing that had ensured the Sildun triumphs over the centuries was their discipline and devotion to the brothers in their own towers. and just now, that was all we had to sustain us. If that failed, we were well and truly doomed. I leaned back against the wood as we jostled over the cobblestones, trying to force myself to breathe and not succumb to panic or despair. Chapter 17. We made our slow trek through the streets, and everywhere it was the same. The deserters that were out already stopped to take us in, the same way humans might if a menagerie of exotic animals were on parade, and word preceded us, as some of the groups were large indeed. But as different as their physicality and fashions were, they still had shops, and traded, and haggled over the price of a bolt of undyed cloth or a tray of strange meats on a corner. They were disturbingly human in that respect. Beyond the pronounced asymmetrical and terraced aspects of most of their architecture, and the lack of color, the other thing that stood out was that, like their clothing, the surface of almost every deserter building was textured in some way, without a smooth surface to be seen. There were indentations and alcoves, ribbed paneling and exotic stucco relief, filigree of stone and metal, holed surfaces that seemed perfect for nesting birds, and a thousand other features designed to add variety and appeal to tactile senses as much as visual ones, which was odd, considering the deserters couldn't see them or possibly reach most of the surfaces. And while there were fewer rows of harvested mossy columns this far into the city, so the low lament was faint and barely audible, there was another noise that sounded like metal chimes of some sort, but with a whirring or humming that accompanied it. As the thoroughfare curved, I saw the source. There were square stone columns periodically lining the street, and they had open sections carved into them where some bronze objects hung. I strained to make them out as we rode past. They looked like spheres composed of strips, with narrower bands inside, and narrower still inside those, and all of them spun when the breeze blew through the obelisk, causing them to hum and whir and chime. We crossed another broad avenue, and I looked in both directions. The left was much as the rest of the city, gray or white, marked by unusual-looking buildings and monochrome deserters, but to the right, far down at the end of the avenue, there was an explosion of color. Bright, brassy, lurid even, and the size of the buildings made it clear they housed humans. I wish Bolto were around, as I wanted to ask someone what that meant. But after the blow he had received already today, he probably wouldn't have been overly inclined to dole out information, even if he had been nearby. We moved on, the street far more winding than anything in Sunrak or even Elspell. While the Sildoon capital was the height of order, and Baron Brune City was haphazard and confusing, the roads generally ran straight. Here they meandered and curved for reasons that had little to do with geography, or any other easily discernible reason. But I saw a massive building in the middle of the city several blocks ahead, rising above the 2- and 3-story buildings we passed. I caught glimpses of it at first, and as we got closer, it was easy to pick out. Looking up, I noticed for the first time that the Veil Dome wasn't complete. There was actually a large hole in the center that made it possible to see the sky above. With the rooters rocking side to side as they pulled our wagon train along, I heard a noise that continued growing louder. At first, it sounded like fast-flowing water, which was strange, as I hadn't seen any rivers near this city, and I doubted there was one running through the middle of it. The sound of rushing water grew louder and more insistent as we neared the central building that dominated Roxtiniac, rising much higher than any tower in Sunrak. The avenue opened up to another broad plaza, and then the largest construction I'd ever seen was laid bare in front of me. It curved off in either direction, and it must have been round or oval in shape, though it was impossible to tell, being so close to it. It was like an inversion of the style of so many of the terraced buildings throughout Roxtiniac, each story extending out a little further than the one below. The extensions weren't all that pronounced themselves. The principles of engineering didn't cease to apply on this side of the Godvale, and you wouldn't build something that was inherently unstable. but there was no denying that each story jutted out slightly more than the preceding one. As we approached the huge structure, this seemed to give it a looming, bulging presence. Several dozen armed deserters were waiting for us in front of some broad steps that led up to colossal double doors on a landing, their wide, flat clubs on their armored shoulders, the spines glinting in the last day's light, seeming to both reflect and absorb the sun. The wagons came to a rest. The human slaves, or servants, bowed low and slunk back away from the deserters who approached. One of the warriors who had been our escort seemed to be reporting, in their odd, guttural, pointed, and rigid-sounding language, to a deserter who had an ugly human in the container on his back. The giants spoke for a few moments, and then the leader of our escort barked some orders, and several slaves sprang back to work, running up to each wagon with keys, unlocking the backs, climbing in, and releasing the chains from the loops inside, but ensuring we were still very much chained together. It felt good to stand again, even though I was now a prisoner or slave. At least I still had legs, unlike the poor bastards on the deserters' backs. Though, I had to remind myself, they would throw a javelin through me in a blink if I misstepped, no matter what common ancestry we had. My muscles were cramped, and I was bending over to rub my thigh when I heard a shout from behind me. I looked back at the other wagon to see what was causing the commotion. As Morgan had his forearm around one of the slaves' necks, and the man's face was turning a garish shade of purple as he was hoisted into the air. As Morgan shouted,
"Give me the key, or I break his scrawny neck."
Muldus muttered, "Plaguing us, these giant horsecocks don't give a single leaky shit about their chattel. Bastard's going to get us all killed."
I almost pointed out Muldus had nearly done the same at the gates with the female deserter, but held my tongue as the large males closed in, spiked hafts at the ready, and some half-humans in barrels holding javelins, arms cocked back to release. Muldus shouted at his Morgan,
"Drop that skinny prick, you dumb plaguing bastard!"
But it didn't look like Esmorgon was in any mood to comply as he spun to face the deserters and repeated his demand. Then Captain Kilcoyne stepped forward and said something quietly to the huge lieutenant. As Morgan shook his furry head, the slave wriggling in front of him, kicking weakly as his air was running out. Braylar said something else, louder this time, though I still couldn't make it out. But the look on his face made it clear he was not in the mood to suffer insubordination. The deserters closed in, weapons still ready, and there was a moment when the ogre's face looked doubtful. But it passed quickly, and his expression hardened. Clearly he wasn't about to back down, even if his pique and pride brought down deserter wrath on every Saldoon prisoner. Braylar kicked the much larger man in the back of the knee, and as he buckled forward a little, the captain struck him in the temple with his elbow 3 times in quick succession, the first 2 as his Morgan released the slave and dropped to a knee, and the final 1 as he started to rise and spin to face the captain. That 3rd elbow to the ear stunned the ogre and sent him to the floorboards. But the captain wasn't taking any chances. He dropped on top of the lieutenant, pinned a massive arm behind Asmorgon's back, and leaned over to say something, presumably to reacquaint him with the necessity of following orders. Vinduru gave a long whistle.
"And here I thought Muldus had the sharpest elbows in the company."
Muldus laughed.
"Where do you think I plaguing learned it from?"
Another Saldoon with 2 missing teeth said,
"Begging your pardon, Lieutenant, that is, Lieutenants, but ought the captain be putting a hurting on Esmorgon like that? I mean, he was only doing what he thought he ought to get us out of this fix."
Muldus turned and looked at the soldier, stared him up and down with his 1 unhooded eye.
"Were you begging pardon for rank stupidity? I'm guessing that's it, am I right? Must have been. Although ain't no apology big enough to make up for a shit-dumb comment like that, because there were 3 things real plaguing wrong with what Esmorgon just pulled there. First, you don't go rogue and put any play in motion without Cap say so,
Even if you are a lieutenant, and even if that play were plenty thought out and liked to put us in a better situation than we currently find ourselves. Second, that play by Asmogon makes your stupidity look pretty inoffensive on the whole. Wasn't going to accomplish much except to win us beatings, lashings, or beheadings.